We made this.
So, where'd you two meet?
Actually, it was at a podcasting conference.
Podcasting? Interesting. Wouldn't have thought you folks would have been into that.
Well, it's not me so much as Sarah. She is quite the early adopter. I mean, she's into these digital audio workstation files and bit depth sample rates and what have you. I mean, God bless her, she's a sucker for all that stuff.
Well, who would have guessed that?
No kidding.
Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. As ever, the truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me for this episode, which is all about Arcadia. Mulder and Scully undercover as a married couple. And I know that Sarah Blair has been waiting for this one for a long time. She's with me. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, poopy head. How's it going?
Not bad, honey bunch. Anyway, joining Sarah and I... as well, is a first-time guest on the podcast. I think I'm right in saying. Not his first appearance, though, because it's none other than Tony Black. Hi, Tony.
Guys, Godspeed.
Does this mean we get to do five questions of X? You've already done them, though. But still.
We could do five more questions of X,
maybe. Has it changed? Has it changed over time?
Probably, yes. Knowing Tony.
Yeah, it's just all the answers are pusher now for every question. That's how it's evolved.
It's
yeah.
Favorite season? Pusher.
Pusher, yeah. Favorite character? Pusher. Favorite moment? Pusher. Anything with pusher.
Or we could have done a spoof five questions of X, couldn't we, where you came on and were like, favorite episode, Fight Club. Favorite character, Kathy Griffin times two.
Yeah, favorite anti question of X. Yeah, no, it is a pleasure to be back as a guest on season six. My first appearance on season six, and I will say at the beginning two things. Number one, it's been awesome so far this season. You guys have done an amazing job, and I have had so much fun enjoying this as just a listener, a fan. So it brings a whole new experience to the podcast I started. It's just been a real ride.
I was going to ask you that. Does it not feel at all weird to be, on the other side of the studio, as it were, not in the hosting chair?
Yeah, I guess so. It's you guys, so not really. Yeah. If it was anybody else, so it's just like it's nice. It's like I get to have all the fun without any of the responsibility. Which is what everyone wants, really. Although I hope, I'm assuming there's plenty of CCNRs for this recording, that we need to follow.
You didn't get the book?
I sent it.
But I didn't read it.
That was a terrible thing.
It might be stuck in the post, but...
Shit. My light's just gone out. Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. My light's gone out. Does this mean that...
It still looks the same to me.
Okay. All right then. Yeah. Okay.
You gotta replace
He's just
that.
Got it. He's
you
just
gotta
got
replace
it.
That. Oh, so
yeah.
Well, speaking of the CCNRs, I hear word on the grapevine that you've got a new pet this morning. And yeah. I need to know if it's over or under £16 worth of pet, because that's a rule.
It's currently 1 kilogram. So, how many pounds are in a kilogram? I should know this, really, shouldn't I?
Hey, Siri.
Do you...
how many pounds are in a kilogram?
1 kilogram is 2.2 pounds.
Okay,
all right, then.
So I'm all right. Yeah. Thank you, Siri. Thank you, Siri. Okay. So I'm all right, yeah. I think my puppy sits, in the CCNRs. I've had to tear myself away from the cutest dog in the world that were cuter than the dog in the episode we're talking about today.
What's her name? We got to know the name.
The name is Rob. No, it's Betty.
Not Scruffy?
Not Scruffy. No, not Scruffy. Should be Scruffy. I did for a long time want to call her Scully, but when you just see a dog and you know a name is right or wrong, she wasn't Scully
so
in this case.
Isn't Betty the name of the tattoo in Never Again? Is that...
Oh.
Is that how you've named her after?
Yeah, I'd love to say that was the case, but yeah. That would mean she's a psychopath. So hopefully not.
Well, you know? Time will tell. I mean.
Yeah,
it's early days.
It is early days.
She's new, so.
Yeah, she is, yeah.
Anyway, we're here to talk about Arcadia, which was first broadcast on the 7th of March, 1999. It was written by Daniel Arkin, and it was directed by Michael Watkins. So Tony, I think as a first-time guest, it's only fair to throw it over to you first of all. Surprisingly divisive episode, it seems like, from our Facebook group this week, which we'll talk about in due course. But where do you sit on this? Are you a fan of Arcadia?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when we talked about me popping back to the X-Cast to do an episode, and the three of us sort of making at least one episode a year, I think straight away we were all like, let's do Arcadia, you know, because it's really good fun, and it's just a really nice way of approaching the characters of Mulder and Scully while doing their normal job, you know, while investigating, but also doing this wonderful spin on the life that the most fans, I'm particularly looking at you, Sarah, want them to have. You know, this happy married existence as a couple in suburbia. And it's just got a lot of really interesting stuff going on. It's this great comment on American life, the American dream, as Win Schroeder at one point says. It's funny. It's quite bloody, surprisingly bloody and brutal at points as well, which I didn't remember.
It's just ketchup
and motor oil. Yeah, sorry. I've always loved it. I have always loved it. And I think it doesn't really depreciate with age. And I have to say that, and I've probably talked before on this podcast, how my wife, who's a massive telly fan, really knows the stuff a lot of the time. I've struggled to get her into the X-Files. And I've yet to manage to pin her down to do a rewatch. And I put on Arcadia last night. She sat down. She was on her phone at first. And by the end, she was desperate to find out if Gene Gogolak was behind all this. So Arcadia, I'll say it now, this is a good entry point, I think, for people. If you want to get them into the X-Files, in a way, I think Arcadia might work in some sense, in some context, you know? So yeah, big fan.
Yeah, maybe. That's interesting. I think your mistake with your wife was, because you tried to watch every episode of her, didn't you? I feel like you needed to go a bit quicker, maybe streamline it a bit, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. I should have put a plan in place. I should have had a let's skip space.
Kathy's got a spreadsheet for that, so.
Yeah. I need that. I need to try again. You know, we got to one breath, which is a good, you know, point to start her off at, I'd say. So, you know, I'll give it another shout.
If she was interested in Arcadia, I might try Detour next, followed by Quagmire. Yeah.
It's not a bad suggestion.
That is a good one. That is a good suggestion. Yeah. Those kind. I think she comes at it from those kind of episodes that Arcadia very much is. You know, it's mm-hmm. X-Files light in many ways. You know, it is accessible, kind of playful X-Files. And, you know, she personally likes a lot of those kind of shows, you know, quite playful shows with character interaction and things like that, mixed with supernatural stuff. And that is Arcadia. It isn't hardcore X-Files in many ways, you know, and I think it's...
I'm going to make up a list for divisive. You, Tony.
Yeah,
I'll make up a list. I think I have a hunch.
Please do. And then I will report back when I'm next on the show about how I've gone.
Tony, can I just pin you down for a mark out of 10? I can't remember if you said. What would you...
I didn't. I'd give this a solid 8 out of 10. It's just great fun. Yeah.
Sarah, what mark would you give this and what are your general thoughts?
My mark, I would say, 8.5, close to 9. You know, anywhere in the 8, high 8. I would have to say, Tony, I partially disagree that this is the life we all want for Mulder and Scully.
I am generalizing.
As a shipper, I cannot see the Lacoste, you know, Mulder with the sweater vest and all of that and the happy little house in the suburbs. When I envision Mulder and Scully together, I envision, you know, the beginning of this where they're just on the couch asleep in the nondescript house in the field. Yeah. And and hanging out. That's the Mulder and Scully I want to see together. But yeah, I do love this episode, and I remember liking it and being very excited about it when it first aired. But I was also a little bit disappointed in the monster. I was like, that's the monster? That's what you got? It's trash.
It's a bit like the monster in the film Dogma, isn't it? The ship monster in Dogma. You know,
right?
It's that, yeah. You know, and that was a comedy. So
it's just, yeah, I remember being disappointed in the monster, but the more I watch it, the more I love it and appreciate it for the silliness that it is. So it's grown on me, and I've come to be endeared to it more than I was when I originally watched. So, and just watching it from a critical standpoint this time, there's so much going on. I mean, not to be like a metaphor for the whole show, but there's so much going on in the underbelly of it all. Like, it's just, you know, you've got everything that's on the surface. It's all shippy and fun and light. And then you've got, you know, the underbelly of it all, which is a lot creepier and a lot more sinister. So I like the layers of it all. It's fun. Makes it a fun episode to dig into.
Yeah, definitely. I'm also an 8. I've always really enjoyed this one, to be fair. And I think that mainly comes from it's seeing David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson playing Fox Mulder and Dana Scully, playing Robin Laura Petrie. No.
How avant-garde.
It's just very fun to see Mulder's idea of what a suburban husband, you know, acts like, basically. And then you've got the awkwardness of Scully kind of reluctantly going along with it. And then she has some moments too where she's kind of in the character and she's trying to get information out of people in quite a nice way too. Yeah, I mean, the monster, it's fair to say, I think it's a weak monster visually, isn't it? I don't think it matters a huge amount to me because the real pull is like that battle between the interlopers and the settled community that they've got there. So I think, you know, the premise of the episode's a bit ridiculous. I think the satire is kind of broad, and arguably it runs a little bit out of steam towards the end. But none of those things bothered me too much, to be honest, because I like the fact there's a clear thematic drive running through the episode. You know, these ideas of like home and community and being a neighbor and conformity and following the rules, all that, being careful what you wish for. I think those ideas are not embedded particularly subtly, if I'm honest. But I think the episode's very good at like presenting them in interesting ways. So really good episode in my book. I'll tell you what's interesting, though, is one of the things you said to us off air, Tony, is that you regarded this as possibly the shippiest episode ever. And then, as you know, we've had the Facebook group discussion this week, which has been really fun. And I've spoken to several shippers who disagree. They acknowledge that it is seen by many as a shipper episode, but these people don't necessarily see it that way themselves. So what did you mean by that? And like, why is it the shippiest episode ever?
Well, I think it's interesting to hear what Sarah said earlier about how this isn't what the kind of shippy episode, the shippy life for Mulder and Scully that she would want to see. And I think that's probably true of a lot of the people who are shippers who don't necessarily love the artifice of this episode. And I think what I'm getting at is that, in theory, I think ultimately what I understand shippers, and I'm sort of agnostic, I'm not anti-shipper, I'm not quite shipper either, I'm in the middle, and I appreciate both camps, but what I understand what real hardcore shippers want is Mulder and Scully to be together, and to be having a family, and to be in love, and this kind of thing. Now, in theory, Arcadia, and this is what's interesting about the episode, because the episode is a big satire on this, and it is talking about this. In theory, that beautiful big home in this perfect community, this idyllic, you know, shall we say, very white middle-class community, is what Americans historically were supposed to aspire towards. This community could have been uprooted from a 1950s sort of picture postcard picket fence version of American life. And I think what I'm getting at is that Arcadia is knowingly, in a way, I think I should have thought it through a little bit more, because I think there is more to it than this. But I think it's on the surface, it's a shippy episode because you've got this artifice of Mulder and Scully cohabiting in a house, playing house, having the odd little, you know, in-character flirt. Mulder just having the time of his life playing Rob and you know, and thoroughly lapping up the flirting with Scully and all these kind of things. So on those surfaces, I feel like it's an episode which really knows about the shippiness of the show. It's an episode that is, you know, almost playing off what fans, by this point, the writers knew fully what they wanted and where they wanted this to go. So I think that's kind of what I'm getting at. But having read some of the discourse and spoken to you guys, there is definitely more to it than that. So it's I will qualify my statement with, it might be a bit rash, and it's interesting to talk about why shippers actually wouldn't want this and what they would want from Mulder and Scully's perfect life, you know?
Yeah, well, we'll read through the mailbag at the end, as we always do, but, you know, we always get a good mailbag, but this was a particularly good one, I think, where opinion was all over the place. So it's fun. It'll be fun to go through that later.
Yeah.
What do you have to add to that, Sarah, what Tony's just said?
I mean, I agree, like, to add on to what I mentioned before, is that I feel like, you know, it is fun to watch them play house. It's just like Mulder says, admit it, you just want to play house. And I think season six, I like to dig into and the relationship stuff, because there's so much going on that I feel happens off the screen. There's just like a tension there, and it's not a good tension coming from Scully. And I feel somewhere they had a big fight that we didn't get to see. There's just I have a feeling it had to do with probably, you know, Diana Fowley. But yeah, so I think that there was something going on since the beginning of season six that they're trying to work through, and it's all off screen, which is really unfair because I would have loved to see all that. But yeah, it's. I mean, they almost kissed in the movie. Mulder literally went to the end of the earth to rescue her. And there's just a lot of stuff going on that they need to work out. And it's all sort of coming to the surface finally in season six. And I think that I would like to see more of that as a shipper. You know, like, and it's not, you know, and as much as I like to talk about, like, ooh, the sexy times and the kissing and all of that. Yeah, I want to see that. But the appealing part to me about the shippy stuff is just, you know, the feelings and them working through being human and trying to connect with each other and trying to, you know, just the characterization of it all is really fascinating to me because they're such rich characters and they've got so much going on. So I think that's where the shippiness comes in for me is, you know, seeing them, like, finally they're in this situation where they could work through a lot of this stuff, but it's all just the monster, you know, it's all focused on that. So,
I mean, one of the relevant factors I'm picking up from the discussions I've had is the fact that in this episode, there's kind of this palpable unease from Scully, isn't there? Where she recoils a bit from Mulder being quite tactile, for instance.
But then there's that moment we'll get to when she does the same thing. She, like, she loses. She's patting his arm and she's like, oh, whoops. I'm not supposed to be doing that.
In the scene of the basketball court. Yeah. So some of the events you're talking about, Sarah, I mean, we've seen the events of One Son, haven't we? Where there's lots going on between Mulder and Scully there that's quite uncomfortable to watch. So the sense I'm getting is that there's an awkwardness to some of the interactions here, which might be off-putting for some. Whereas some of the other episodes you would think of as big shipper favourites, but perhaps they're more in harmony, is the idea I'm hearing. I think it's fair to say the concept here is one which is likely to hold more allure for shippers, isn't it? If you just looked at the one-sentence description of Mulder and Scully go undercover as a married couple, and then, of course, you've got the episode which is sort of saying what you see isn't always what you get, and, you know, you've got these ideas of, you know, the things it does about not putting the toilet seat down and that kind of those kind of gestures to a mundane relationship. I think that element of discord, though, that's there, I think that's important. It's important, in my view, because if you're a viewer who really doesn't like it when the show goes down the shipper route, you know, what you're getting, though, is the version of married bliss they're enacting is so obviously a caricature, isn't it? It's impossible to take it seriously. Except the idea being that the locals do take it seriously because they've got this idealized view of what a suburban couple should be like. So I think that's quite clever, personally. I think if they played it more naturalistic and, you know, tried to be a more believable married couple, I don't think the episode would have been as successful.
Mm, yeah. That's kind of what I mean about the artifice, because that's the key. You know, it's that we know that they're playing characters, but it's based on, you know, a lot of the nods and winks that the show has made towards them getting closer and becoming a couple. And the fact by now, this show absolutely understands what the shipper relationship is between these two. And as he's doing lots of episodes, particularly this season, you know, Triangle, The Rain King, where they are, you know, absolutely playing towards that and nudging the audience and saying, hey, we know you like this. We know. And this is the ultimate version of that for me. This is like the ultimate version of that knowing, understanding of this. What has evolved out of the characters and the performers over the years, you know? Because at the beginning, this wasn't part of the plan necessarily, you know. It's come out of their chemistry and their dynamic and how it's developed and how the show's become more about their lives and their families. So Arcadia is the ultimate expression of that in many ways, and I think that's the point of it. So, and I think that's why I enjoy it. And maybe weirdly enough, it's on that basis, it's easier to enjoy if you're not completely a shipper. You know, maybe that is it. Maybe that's the whole point.
Yeah, maybe. I was wondering why it was so divisive based on the comments we've had, because I'd never realised that it was. I'd always assumed this was a broadly popular episode, to be honest with you. So we need to acknowledge that, you know, we said that maybe this concept holds more appeal to shippers, but as Sarah's indicated, what all shippers want is not exactly the same. You know, even if they do want Mulder and Scully to be together, it doesn't necessarily look like this. Having said that, though, I still think it's understandable that an episode that's kind of skewering the idea of a peaceful domestic life, like a blissful married cohabitation, I can understand why that's not to all tastes. And then I think there are viewers who are desperate for things not to go down that route, who don't even want to see like a jaundiced treatment of it, you know what I mean? So maybe that's why it's off putting to some on either end of the spectrum. I don't know. I'm not in either of those camps. I really like the episode. You know the labels of shipper, no Romo, I've never really subscribed to any of them, to be honest. I don't like to be labeled.
You're an individual. Yeah. You know, you're not a number. You know, you're a free man, Carl.
Contrarian, Carl.
Sarah, I was going to ask you about this idea of the planned community, because, you know, I'm not really familiar with that from my own lived experience, as it were, just from representations of that kind of thing on screen. But what about you? You've lived in California. Were you in a kind of an Arcadia Falls type area?
Not in... Well, we did have a cute little neighborhood, but I was never really in that kind of a situation out there. But here in Georgia, we do have an HOA, a homeowners association. And we've had some drama. You know, we have to pay our dues every year. And they've switched companies.
Come on, give us the gossip.
Oh, yeah. So one time, the big fuss was when somebody noticed that they were measuring the front entrance for a gate. And that set off just the measuring. Why is somebody measuring? Is that for a gate? Are we going to get a gate? We don't want to be a gated community. Are we going to get a gate? Who's talking about a gate? And boy, that set everybody off, because there was like the people who wanted the gate. It was like a gate. And they wanted, like, there were the people who, like, no gators and gators and, like, people in between who were like, well, we want a gate, but we don't want it to be, like, you don't have to have a code, you just have to have a gate. And, like, it was, like, a whole big to-do about that, big fuss. And, you know, we would have, because, you know, everything has to look a certain way. We all have to look the same. So, you know, we have black mailboxes. So we get notices all the time about things, like everybody does. But, you know, we got notices about our mailbox needing to be painted. You got to paint your mailbox. It's looking a little shabby. You got to paint it. We've got notice. We get notices all the time because I'm not a gardener, so we get weeds. So like there have been days out there where I'm like, oh, I got to get out there and weed. You know, especially in the spring when everything is coming up, and they have a little car that drives around. It's the HOA police. They drive around and take pictures of everybody's yard and turn, and they're like, we've taken this picture to show that there are too many weeds in your yard. Please fix this or you will be fined. So you get a letter with the picture of your yard in it. And So one day I was like, and I tried to pay attention so I would like note what days they would come around of the week. And so one morning, I was like, oh no, my mother-in-law was out. She likes to walk. She's like, Sarah, the HOA police are coming, get out. And so we were out there weeding the garden when they were driving by to take pictures. And I was like, nope, you're not going to get us this time.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah. I find it so ironic, and this ties into Arcadia, that people in America go along with this kind of thing, given how protective and fiercely, you know, protective they are about their independence and their freedom homeowners and as citizens. And yet people will live in these communities where they literally have neighborhood watch police making sure they garden properly. And it's like, how do they put up with that? Especially in America. It's bizarre.
It is. And it would be, I think, much more effective if we had a trash monster to regulate things than a little car with a person taking pictures. But, you know, we can't have solar panels. We'd live to have solar panels on our roof. We're not allowed to have those. I want to get bees. Can't have bees and chickens. Can't do that. So, yeah. It's not in the CCNRs.
I mean, it sounds like quite a frightful business, I've got to be honest, Sarah. I was thinking about this in terms of on-screen, though. You know, the idea of suburbia's dark underbelly is quite a familiar one, I think. And you can pin it back to lots of precedents. You know, there are melodramas from the 50s.
Stepford Wives.
All That Heaven Allows. Yeah, Stepford Wives in the 70s, or Blue Velvet in the 80s. Or
Twin Peaks.
Very, very much so. There's a film called The Colony from a few years before this episode, which I haven't seen, but apparently that's about a very prescriptive planned community too. So the basic idea being that these kind of homogenous environments, they give you the cover for these kind of exclusionary practices that the dominant culture puts in place. It's quite a familiar one, like I say, but it's quite a potent one, isn't it? Because you get a lot of stuff out of it. You get these oppositions of like order and chaos, the service and the underbelly, conformity, individuality, rule followers, rule breakers. So I think there's good stuff. And I think Arcadia, for the most part, is a successful iteration of that kind of story, isn't it, Tony? Do you know what I mean? Do you see it in that kind of lineage of, like you say, the Twin Peaks or the Blue Velvet kind of stories?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's reaching for those same kind of touchstones because it is very much about this, you know, fear of non-conformity, this anxiety about, you know, if we don't conform and we don't hold to rules and laws, as petty and as ridiculous as they are, then we are going to, you know, sow the seeds of our own downfall, and that we're going to be in danger, and the monster, as much as the monster's a bit rubbish, literally, it is essentially the literalization of that fear. And that's really interesting that the underbelly in this case, in classic X-Files fashion, the underbelly actually does exist, and it literally rises up and kills you if you dare. So it's not working on any sort of, it's very literal in many ways, this episode. It's not working on a metaphorical context. It is bringing a literalization to it. But that's the joy of it, I think. That's the joy of it. And that's X-Files doing that classic thing where it takes a metaphorical idea, a very woven into the American story, and makes it and uses monsters and uses a supernatural and uses something horrific to literalize it. And I think that this is a great example of that, and it does it really well.
So just before we get into the episode in depth, do you two want to hazard a guess what this gets on IMDb? I'll give Tony the first go because he's returning for the first time in a while. For the nearest decimal point, please, Tony.
Well, as you know, as we know, they always go up to, they never really go past the nines very often, do they? And they don't tend to fall usually below the sevens. So I reckon Arcadia is about an 8.2.
That's exactly what I was going to guess.
Really?
I'm going to go, just to be different.
Higher or lower?
I might go 8.6.
Okay.
It is 8.6 out of 10.
Oh, well done.
Well done.
And I didn't even look.
Very good. Yeah.
Does that suggest, Sarah, that you normally do look, you know, by saying that? I didn't even look this time.
I do, yeah.
looking is not in the CCNRs of the show, Sarah.
A lot of the times I'm the host, so I have to look.
That's true. That's a good point.
Fair enough.
That puts it equal 8th for the season on IMDb, and that puts it alongside Drive and The Unnatural. What do you reckon about that? I think I might have had it a touch higher than eighth, maybe. What do you guys?
I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
Not that's a bad position, but...
Yeah, I don't know if it's quite as good as Drive, necessarily. I think I like this a bit more than The Unnatural, but The Unnatural's its own beast, really, in many ways. I suppose, yeah. I suppose it's... I'd say that's about right, really, to be fair.
Yeah.
I think The Dreamlands and 2001 Sun were above this, and I think I'd have Arcadia above those episodes. But, yeah.
Maybe The Dreamlands, yeah, I think I'd agree with that, yeah.
Sarah, you think it's about right, do you?
Yeah. Well, because the Dreamland episodes are... I mean, I know you guys... I know the dance takes it down for you, Carl.
I love the dance. Honestly, I love the dance.
I think, well, the Dreamland episodes, you know, you've got Mulcher, the whole Mulcher thing, and Morse Fletcher. I think he really brings it up a notch for people, just having him on there. And it's the two-parter, so I think that gains it some points. I think the story is a lot more solid than Arcadia. I mean, I would say, like, Arcadia is fun and it's a good story, but I feel like maybe, like, the reasoning and the plot behind the monster stuff is a little bit weak, on the weak side. So that's what brings it down, I think, just below a 9 for me. But, yeah I think Dreamland is really solid as far as structure and pacing and all that goes. So maybe that's why I get a little bit higher.
It's very debatable, I would say.
that is Carl's classic diplomatic. No, don't
I'm
agree.
Wrong. You can just say you're wrong. Just say you're wrong. It's fine.
That would be dreadfully impolite of me.
No, it's fine. We're friends. We're all friends here.
Guys, I think it's about time that we take a look underneath the dark underbelly of Arcadia.
Let's do it.
Okay, then. So let's get into the episode. We're in San Diego. You know, we've got twinkly Mark Snow score. We've got this community. It looks really good, I think. You know, the flowers, and you've got that very insistent keypad voice when he's got to punch his code in. Dave Klein is his name. So, yeah, there's this dispute about the painted mailbox, or he had it painted the wrong shape.
Sage. Desert Sage. He's got to be Desert Sage.
Instead of Desert Sienna.
Desert Sienna. Yeah. He went Desert Sage.
And he kind of, you know, he speaks to his wife. He refers to them, that'll show these Nazis, is what he says. And he puts the thing on his roof that we find out later that Mr. Gogolak has sent him, it seems like. And he meets a grisly end. So what do you guys think in this teaser? I think it sets up the key themes pretty nicely, to be honest.
Yeah, it's good. I think I'd say the Kleins are up there as one of the most normal couples ever on The X-Files. Like, you know, I mean, they say it later on, don't they, Scully, when she's doing her inter-camera thing about how they're no history of mental health problems, no problems with the law, nothing like that. Completely normal people, the kind of people that you might know, who are looking at all of this thinking, these people are nuts. Like, these people are crazy. And also, like, the Nazis comment is really interesting, I think, because obviously, in theory, this whole community is completely different from the idea of very, you know, tightly restricted kind of autocratic kind of, you know, but it's not at the same time. You know, he says it in a jokey way, but Gogolak and these rules are it's very, very counter to the freedoms and liberal, you know, ideas of America. So it's really interesting that Dave is... He's talking about them in those terms, even before he dies, you know, and it's said in an offhand way, but I think it kind of gets to the core of what this is about in many ways.
I think so too, because I think that's where conformity, that's kind of an end point for where conformity takes you.
Yeah.
So in this teaser, we see the monster briefly, don't we? I think from the very first appearance, and it's only fleeting, you know, we only see the monster in glimpses for obvious reasons, I think. But you can tell there's something not quite right about it immediately, can't you? It's not perfect.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wondered, I was screaming at the screen, because why doesn't she just go out the window? It's big. It's open. Get out the window. You can just jump out on the roof. That's what I would have done, but, you know, it's fine.
But that happens all the time. That happens all the time in these kind of shows. But it happens in all these shows. Like, people, like, they have time. Like, when they see a monster coming towards them, half the time it's like all the way across the room, and they're there looking at it and then waiting and then screaming, and it's like, just leg it, just go.
I would like to believe, I don't know if this would be the case, but I would like to believe if I heard my husband getting murdered downstairs, I would make a run for it. I don't know. I wouldn't just sit there under the covers, but who knows? I have never been in that experience before. So.
Let's hope you never will. Also,
Also, one thing that I did notice is, I don't know about in the UK, but here, you know, we've got a lot of people, not at my house, but a lot of people would have a gun next to the bed. A lot of people, and we have an iron bar under the bed, or like a baseball bat. Yeah. You know, you guys don't keep stuff like that just in case?
I think some do.
No, just a cup of tea, really.
You just invite the monster in for tea then.
I think some people might in the UK, but it's, yeah, cricket I would bat. Say it's, yeah, a cricket bat, yeah, yeah. Literally, that sounds like a joke, but it actually isn't.
No, yeah. No,
it's true. Yeah.
But we have a bar.
Not so much the guns.
So, if the trash monster comes, we're going for the bar. The iron bar.
I can kind of believe that you would be frozen in place if something really scary is happening to you.
Yeah. I mean, it's believable, I think, but after a certain point, I would go for my kids, but I don't think they had kids, so.
No.
No.
7 months later, we pick up with Mulder and Scully moving in as the Petries, not the Petries. It's just fun immediately, isn't it? Mulder playing the part, you know, the sweater around his shoulders.
Amazing. Amazing. That shot of him, that pan up him, is so knowingly like, let's do this. Let's take the mic. So very good. Very good.
And of course, I think deliberately moving in late to kind of test the boundaries with the CC&Rs.
The CC&Rs, didn't they? I wonder how much they read of them beforehand. That's one thing that jumped out at me is when it's 7 months later, and this could have been different in the 90s now, I'm not saying, but when we lived in California, I will tell you that real estate, like if there was a house available for sale, it was like a shark fest.
Yeah.
You know, especially in a neighborhood that's like the top rated neighborhood in this whatever, you know, like fits in the top rated anything. People are going to be all over that. So I cannot imagine in my brain, just from my experience of living out there, how this house could have possibly been on the market for 7 months without people living there.
And also, how does it fit with the overall timeline? If Skinner's given them this assignment and then they had to organize buying the house, but Skinner's only been their boss not long. And
Mulder makes the comment, doesn't he, about how this is their first catch back on the X-Files. Obviously, we've had Aguamala and Mundy before this, haven't we? Which were both... But they were definitely back in the office by Monday, weren't they? So, like, even though it was... So, yeah, what's the... I'd love to know the timeline.
Well, I think the production order was that this was produced immediately after One Son.
Right, okay.
And then it was aired 2 episodes later than it would have gone out in that order, because... Okay. I believe what you hear is that it was post-production issues where the monster wasn't necessarily the visual masterpiece they wanted it to be.
This is a surprise.
Yeah, and that needed a bit more work. But I suppose you could say that in Aguamala, Arthur Dales calls them in, doesn't he? And in Monday, they're in the office, but they're not really on a case. They're just in that meeting, aren't they? So.
If the monster needed more work, I would like to have seen the original if this is what they came up with after more work.
I can tell you that the writer, so Daniel Arkin, he was inspired to write this apparently based on an incident that had happened to him. So he'd moved into an uptight planned community in Greenwich Village, and his movers turned up late, and he hadn't read this like 300-page document that he should have about all the restrictions, and he immediately got fined $1,000 for moving in after the approved time. So then when he was tasked with writing a story for the X-Files, he very quickly came to the idea of the frightening nature of planned communities. So like I say, so we get Mulder and Scully moved in, and, you know, Scully's unease, like I said earlier, is palpable. There's lots going on, you know, Mike dropping the china, which is actually their equipment and all that. This sets up the idea of a basketball hoop when Mulder wants to put that up. It's just fun, isn't it, Tony? Like I said, to see Mulder really going for that part of, like, the standard suburban man, standard suburban husband, in such a broad way. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I think in all honesty, I think it's David Duchovny, like, going for it as well. You know, I think he I've said before on this podcast, there are some weeks where he's bored to death, you know, and you can tell, like, by the script. And there are some weeks where he's just loving every minute of it. And this is definitely one of the latter, I think. I think he had an absolute ball. And it's whether or not some, I mean, I would not be surprised if some of his dialogue was improvised, to be honest, at various points. Because he's definitely got the ability to do that. He's funny enough as a person. He's got a gift for that. And he's a good writer. So I think he's definitely taken this, you know, this idea of lampooning, you know, an archetype that goes all the way back to the 50s, doesn't it? Because Robin Laura Petrie is originally the names of the Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore, isn't it, on the Dick Van Dyke Show? So, and that too now is being lampooned itself on stuff like WandaVision lately, you know, on Disney Plus. So these kind of things are, you know, and that in a way has some connective tissue to Arcadia and these kind of, and there's quite a few shows and TV series that have done this play on this perfect American suburbia. But he knows how much... it's like Duchovny's having fun playing Mulder, who is having fun playing, like you said earlier, I think one of you said earlier, the American husband, which he knows he's never going to be, you know? And then
he doesn't want to be.
And so later on, you've got those great scenes of Mulder just throwing his stuff everywhere and Scully's, like, picking it up and then going, what have you done to this toothpaste? Because you know, Mulder is just... He is ultimate single-man life, Mulder, you know? In how he lives. So it's great. It's just, it's very knowingly doing all these things.
Do you think that that's part of the big appeal of this episode is just watching them have so much fun with it? Because it is for me.
Yeah.
And like the same with Dreamland, you know, they're just the ones that they can have fun with, and the unnatural is the same. And just watching, that's season six is just a lot of fun that way, I think.
I think it's fair to make the point as well that much as Duchovny is lapping it up, I think in her own way, so is Gillian Anderson. Because I think she is very much enjoying Scully's intentional sort of irritation and restraint. And Mulder is far, far funnier because of that, because of how she reacts, because of those moments. It wouldn't work in the same way, you know, if you didn't have her looks and asides and just that constant sort of, really? You know?
kind of thing. It is fun to watch them and how comfortable they are with each other and how great they are and how well they know the characters and how they react in character. And, you know, it's really fun and how they just play off of each other. That's always fun to watch.
And also with other people, because, like, Gillian Anderson, I guess, is kind of sing-song quality to her voice when she's talking, like when she's talking to Mike, who brings the china over, and she's like, "I can't believe the Klein's ever left."
Yeah.
I don't know about you though, Sarah, but I can't help but be a bit sad that we didn't get the scene of Skinner sitting them down and saying, "Right."
Every time I think assignment. About that, I'm just like, "Oh, I would have loved to watch that. That would have been a lot of fun." Just having him, he would. Just, oh my gosh, the look on his face. He would have loved, talk about having fun. That would have been a fun scene to play out.
Yeah, I think Skinner would have been smirking, you know, all the way through. Mulder would have been like, this will be great fun. And Scully would have just been sitting there going, oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Have we got to do this?
And how much do you want to bet that Skinner... Maybe he doesn't think that this is, like, a good X-File, but he just really wants Mulder. Maybe Skinner's the one who really wants Mulder and Scully to play house. It's not, you know, admit it, Skinner, you just want to see us play house.
Yeah. Mulder would totally say that to him, wouldn't he? Totally. Yeah.
It seems to me, though, from reading our comments that we've had in, that there are some people who just can't get past the ludicrousness of the idea that, it seems like so ridiculous inherently, you know, like something out of, I think it's Caradwen who says it's like a bad fanfic trope.
I think it's an interesting comment though, definitely, because I think you would have had many fanfics potentially before this that would have done something along these lines or some kind of Mulder and Scully, but it wouldn't have had that edge of satire, I think, that this does, and that edge of knowing full well that they're playing characters. So, yeah, it is a fair point, though. And that, again, is part of why it's a mixed bag for some.
Okay, so when we see that scene at the Gogolak house, when they're talking about the Petries, it was interesting to me, Tony, because you get that moment where the women leave the table, leaving the men to talk, don't you? So it's clearly this kind of quite markedly patriarchal community, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the upshot of the scene is that Mike apparently is the weak link within that community. But I think it goes back to the idea I was talking about of the shiny surface of the community conceals the power structure that's going on. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's where he says, "Ladies, my compliments to the chef," and then they know. That's our cue. It's so old-fashioned. Yeah. And even for when it's made, I mean, like I say, this it's almost like they've stepped into the 1950s. It's like they've stepped into 40 years before where these roles, you know, and systems existed. I mean, you'll appreciate this, Sarah, particularly as a big fan of this, but it reminded me in some ways of Mad Men, actually. And that kind of scene I could have imagined in Mad Men when, you know, all the ad guys are in the bar, you know. And then, and you've got the whole point of that show is you've got these strong women who are sort of making their mark in a very man's world. And that's what Gogolak has created here, I think. He's created this community that is based on, as you say, patriarchy, old-fashioned conservative patriarchy. And I think without necessarily the I don't mean that in terms of the politics as such. I mean that in terms of the old-fashioned sort of mindset. It's interesting that Mike is not like that. He's
not married, apparently.
He's unmarried. He's quite gentle. He's like a gentle giant. And he immediately says, doesn't he? Why don't we just tell them? Because I don't want anyone else to die, basically. That's what he's saying. And at that point, Gogolak sees weakness as opposed to, you know, Gogolak doesn't want to bring new people in. It feels like he wouldn't even want to sell that house in a weird way. It's like he's got the people he wants, and that's how kind of how he wants to keep it, unless they accept all rules, they accept all conformity, and they become part of this entity as such. It's weird. You know?
There was the... I think there's a line somewhere in there that hints that this community was formed by a specific group of, like, the original people, and they all bought into that, and that's what they wanted and what they started, and then it's evolved into this thing that nobody expected and a lot of people don't want anymore. And
but it was only 1991, though. That's really interesting. Like, you know, it wasn't like it was 1951, which I thought would have made more sense, you know, in a way.
But it's interesting to see, you know, like, to guess, like, are the people who that we see in the neighborhood, because it's a big neighborhood, I think. Are those the people that are the original group, the ones sitting at the table? They were all there originally, and then, you know, things have changed, and then, but there's other people maybe that are not part of the core that set that up.
Is this, here's a question for you both. Is this whole scenario a prosaic, mundane syndicate? Like, these people, these involved in this conspiracy, protecting this great big secret, this dark underbelly, is this basically just a very small scale gated community, white picket fence version of the alien conspiracy, the syndicate, this led by this old grey-haired white man, where the women kind of have a supplicant role if they're there at all, and it's just these men around the table? And then the moment you get a Bill Mulder who doesn't want to conform to it, or the moment you get, you know, a Kurzweil or whoever, he's killed.
I think they're worse than the Syndicate in some ways. Because, no, they are. Because the Syndicate at least had a dilemma. You know, the dilemma being that the aliens are coming. Here, this is just what they wanted, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And or the Gogolak Syndicate, wanted. Yeah. Well, the Syndicate, you know, formed because of the aliens. Whereas this, the monster was formed because of these people. So it's kind of reverse. So, like, the Syndicate, yeah, I agree with you, Carl, that these people are worse because they came up with this. they wanted these things so badly that they, you know, metaphysically formed this trash monster. who has, you know, who's started killing people and has gotten out of control and they can't control anymore. So
Gene Gogolak is a crap version of the cigarette smoking man who's more evil, basically.
Yeah. Or is he more of a struggle?
Yeah.
Or maybe, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I'd go with struggles, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So here's what I wanted to ask you both was that, so remember we get the scene when Mike's at home just before he gets taken out, you know, he's watching a documentary which is about failure to conform within the tribal structure can often prove lethal and all that. So drives home the underlying theme in a manner reminiscent of Home, you know, where Mulder watches the thing on the TV in his room.
And Detour, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, one of the things I've picked up in some of the reviews of the episode is some people who feel like it's, ironically, it's all on the surface, like it's kind of obvious what it's doing. Is it a fair criticism? Because something like that is quite upfront, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said earlier, it isn't very deep in a way, this episode. I think it is all there. It is all quite part of that. I don't know if that's a bad thing in this case. I don't know. It doesn't work for me. It doesn't work to the detriment. I feel like it's a very colourful, broad, quite comedic take on this idea for the most part.
Yeah.
And I think it knows it. So, yeah, I think it's a very, very valid criticism, but it doesn't work as a negative for me.
Doesn't bother me. Like I said earlier, I think that it is obvious and it's also, you know, it's an interesting spin on it. So it doesn't concern me unduly.
I think it goes with the theme. Yeah, I mean, it is, but I don't care. You know, like you guys said, it's just, it's part of the whole piece and it fits in with the tone. So I don't think it doesn't bother me.
What's maybe slightly less kind of in your face, but still very relevant to the theme, I really like the shot of his welcome mat, which then gets like splattered with blood.
Yeah, that's really good. You know? Yeah.
And then the very next shot after the act break is that blood being washed away. So that idea of the inviting surface appearances and the bloody reality, you know, really nice. Okay, so then Mulder and, you know, there's some really great dialogue, isn't there, in this episode? All the stuff about, oh, we spooned up and fell asleep like little baby cats.
Yeah. That's right, poopy head.
Honey bunch. Does he call her honey bunch? Is that what it is?
Honey bunch, yeah.
Yeah.
It just makes me think of small potatoes with Babu and...
Yeah.
I suppose that's in similar terrain, isn't it? Small potatoes, because that's sort of playing off the idea of like these suburban families too, isn't it?
Yeah. And Mulder playing a role.
Yeah. Is this basically a mashup of Small Potatoes and Home with a little bit of Detour in there, maybe?
Yeah.
Well, maybe it is, like, you know?
Yeah.
If you can imagine such a beast.
Well, Our Town isn't that a relevant one, too?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Our Town is about the community with the secret as well.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah.
These town folk have been eating more than just chicken. Sorry, I just love that line from Our Town. They've been eating more than just chicken. Yeah.
Sarah, you mentioned a moment where Scully returns Mulder's affection. That's the scene with Gogolak, isn't it, where he's told that he can't have the basketball hoop. Is that the one you were talking about?
Yeah, where they're sitting, the one where they're sitting on the couch. And she keeps forgetting to not touch him. And it's hilarious. I love it so much. Where she just, like, there's two times. Once at the beginning and then once again where she's just patting his hand. And then you can see her, like, glance down and, like, pull her hand away. She's like, oh, right. She's like falling into this, you know, habit. It's fun to watch Gillian Anderson play it because on the one hand, like they're very comfortable with each other after all this time as actors. And, you know, they've been around each other so much that they're very the people as actors are comfortable being around each other. And then you've got her playing Scully, who is also comfortable being around Mulder after all this time, which there's just so many layers upon layers upon layers. It's so fun.
Yeah.
And she just, to watch them both, you know, David Duchovny playing it as he's just so excited to be able to have an excuse to touch Scully and just be near her. And then she just forgets and doesn't think about it. And then she remembers and it's just like, oh, right. Whoops. And then, yeah.
I just love his every opportunity to make like boorish husband man jokes. Like, woman, get back in here and make me a sandwich. And her looks. I just looked at him to say.
That's my favorite moment of the whole episode.
It's
where
brilliant.
The camera, she just stays. It's like 1 second extra.
It just
stays on her. And she just stares.
She makes it funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the best. And then the gloves come. It's completely brilliant.
My favorite moment of the episode is also a Scully moment, but it's when Mulder makes that quip with the Schroders about dolphins being tasty. And there's that awkward silence, and then Scully gives that really forced laugh.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That is so good.
Genius.
Yeah. Because that's Scully going, oh my God, what is he saying? Like, you know, she's having to sort of, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. He makes her so uncomfortable, and that's such great comedy. It's so good. And he's having fun doing it. That's the thing. He knows fully what he's doing.
They know each other's buttons. I think that's one of the things that you could argue makes it very shippy, is that they know each other's buttons and they're both pushing them. And it works. It works really nicely.
Like when he says that they met at a UFO conference.
All that new age, those magnetic bracelets, man.
Crystals. So good. So good. But then they also, in that scene, they also work well together, don't they, in the sense that it's almost like they've rehearsed their plan to try and trick information out of them, you know, where he says, oh, well, we called Mike's office, didn't we, honey? You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's really good, because they've obviously thought that through, and they've, you know. So, yeah, it's a good balance of both.
And also when they sort of press a bit further, and they talk about, you know, maybe he's got some wild secret life, you know, every community's got its dark underbelly, doesn't it, Wynn?
Yeah, well, that's brilliant. Yeah, he's just, everyone's got his dark underbelly, and he just looks at him, and he's just, oh, it's great. And we were laughing our heads off at that. Like, just, it's so good.
And then when they're walking the dog, and Scully's like, so you brought us by Mike's house twice. Are you worried about him? Are you worried about him, huh?
there are quite a few moments where I feel like Cammy or Wynn or whatever should go, you guys are asking a lot of questions, because Scully will always be going, they were the Kleins, right? They were called the Kleins, right? And he's just like, guys, pull it back a little bit. Yeah.
Maybe Skinner's like listening. Maybe they've got things bugged or whatever. Skinner's just like, jeez, guys,
too many questions.
It's a good job that the CCNRs mandate that the dogs have to be under 16 pounds, because otherwise I don't think that animal would have got in the gutter, would
no.
it?
No.
Convenient.
Very lucky.
I did like that part. That's a fun scene.
I think so too. I was thinking similar to what Tony mentioned a bit earlier, because Wynn talks about this is the American dream, in my opinion. And I was thinking, well, as I understand the general concept of the American dream, isn't it more normally associated with people having the right to do what they want? If you work hard enough, you can have exactly what you want. And they kind of conflate it with this post-war affluent kind of lifestyle, don't they? But so there's obviously something kind of antithetical, you know, going on there, where you can't do what you want within these very prescribed communities. So what do you reckon, Sarah? What is the American dream?
Oh. Well,
brace yourself for a 3-hour podcast,
oh
guys.
God. As far as
should we get Darren Mooney? We need Darren Mooney in front of this, don't we?
As far as the, you know, being in this, having the rules and being in this community, I think the key there is it's a choice. You don't have to do it. If you want to go live in the middle of a field, you have that choice. And so when people, you know, go in and buy into these gated communities, that's an obvious, you know, option. It's not, nobody's forcing you into it. So I think that's where like the idea of freedom comes in. Like, this is a choice. This is something that we all agree to, that we all want as a community. So, you know, as much as we like to fuss about it, you know, that's just part of it, I guess. It's like fussing about all the rules, like all these rules. But you know, we chose that. To be fair,
I've just done the Monday podcast with Kurt and Cortland, and I've concluded that free will doesn't really exist. So, anyway, go on, Tony.
That's going to be a fun listen. I wonder though, because it's funny you saying that, how they've chosen this conformity and they've chosen to live by these rules, even though in theory they've, you know, the American dream is this materialistic, in some sense, this materialistic sense of affluence, as you say, Carl, of success, of achievement, of, you know, the house, the beautiful house, the family, etc. So in a weird way, they've almost chosen what Americans have been terrified of since the 1940s, you know, of the idea of what they perceive as either slash communism, socialism, which is still terrifying Americans today in some quarters. And I mean, there was an episode, it's funny, there was an episode of Alias, which is a TV show, obviously, that it owes a hell of a lot to The X-Files in many ways, even though it's a different kind of show. And they did an episode called Welcome to Liberty Village, which was about a town just like the falls in Arcadia that was created in Russia to train American spies, to train Russian spies to act like Americans. And in fact, I think the TV show The Americans, which is all about that, set in the 1980s, very much it comes off the back. The Americans is basically Alias with swearing and sex, essentially. It is the same kind of show, right? And it plays off the back of the episode, and the two CIA characters have to go undercover into that Russian village that's pretending to be American as Americans who are trying to smoke out Russians pretending to be Americans, if that makes sense, right? Yeah. Did that make sense? I'm not sure that makes sense.
It does.
Anyway,
yeah.
Right. That was the irony of it. They had this whole secret Russian. So it was a little bit of The Prisoner. It was a little bit of Arcadia. And it was a fascinating episode. And it was really good. And obviously, it's much more pulpy and spy and everything like that. But it goes back to the idea that the Russians were creating these American villages to train spies to go and become the kind of people that we see in the falls in Arcadia. So it's fascinating to me how people like Wynn and Cammy have convinced themselves that this is the dream, when in reality, it's the Russian dream. You know, in a way, they've conflated it with the ideas of what Americanism should be. And I think that's fascinating.
Well, Cammy, at least, is very uneasy about it.
Mm.
Yeah. And yeah, how much do you think that's due to, you know, if they're, say they're in their 30s in the 90s, like 30s, 40s-ish, right? So that would be the kid. They would have grown up with, you know, the parents who were those people. So maybe that's why they want to try to go back to that, to like recapture something of their childhood, or like what their parents' dreams were, or something like that. Maybe this might be part of it.
Yeah, maybe.
Too.
Or at least the imagined version.
Like the ideal that they were raised to believe was ideal, you know. Quotes, air quotes of ideal,
we get the stuff with Mulder and Scully at home, where Scully's in the bathroom as they're talking about the case and all that. Mulder's on the bed with his shoes on the bed, which I don't think is good form. And Scully's talking about squeezing the tube of toothpaste and putting the toilet
seat
down.
Second warning.
yeah, that was pretty. Well, you know, funnily enough, right, when she said that and about the toothpaste, my wife just turned to me and looked at me with that kind of... my look is basically saying, ringing any bells, Tony?
Is this... Because you guys are both not married to each other, but you're married to other people. So is this a fair representation of married life? I'm like a...
I have to give points to my husband. He's very good about putting the toilet seat down. So I never had that problem.
I've got better, but I still have days. I'm definitely Mulder, though, for being an untidy so-and-so, just throwing things about. My wife has the patience of a saint. She doesn't always realise it, to be fair.
We use different brands of toothpaste, so we don't have that problem either. That's the key to happy marriage, just different brands of toothpaste.
I'll remember that, yeah. That's good.
What about, I've seen somebody critique the moment where she comes out with a face mask and it's a little bit too kind of silly.
I did. That was one of the few notes that I made. I'm curious because this is their second night. So like, if I were using a face, I don't use face masks much, but when I do, it's not every night. So, there are some face masks that you would use every night. This one I wouldn't say would be one of them, but it is... I found that it was interesting that she would use it on the second night and not the first night. Mm. I think there's something interesting there to dig into that, you know, maybe logically speaking, it's probably just that it wasn't the night to do it and then the second night is. You know, she's got a routine. She's got to have a routine and stick to it, Scully. But yeah,
yeah, I was thinking of it more in terms of the idea of things not being what they seem on the surface.
Yeah.
Like, we see how fabulous Scully looks all the time. We don't see all the grooming that goes into making Gillian Anderson look so fabulous.
I think as well, it's a good way of showing how different Mulder and Scully are, because Mulder, when he sees that on, he's like, what the hell is that? Like, Jesus. Right. And he has no idea that Scully would do these grooming things in her own life when she's at home all the time, probably. Like, whereas Mulder doesn't even have a bed. He sleeps on the couch. Like, you know, so it's like.
In his bathroom. Actually, no, he does have a bed. Scully's house.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right. So it's so far away from any kind of world he understands that when he sees these things, he's that's the whole thing with this. He has no idea how to live this kind of life. And that's what makes it so funny.
Well, I'll tell you another unceremonious thing he does is when he drinks orange juice straight from the bottle, of course, when he's, because he goes out and like kicks his mailbox over and all that, and he's trying to provoke a reaction. So I really like that aspect of the episode, that battle that goes on between him and the system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mulder is terrible at surveillance, just, you know, because like the number one rule of surveillance is to never, ever take your eyes off what you're surveilling. Yeah. Like that's an actual rule. The FBI, like, you know, don't ever take your eyes off the target for any reason. But also,
if you're going to do that, don't drink a whole bottle of orange
juice. Don't do it. Don't get like, the orange juice and hang out. Like, that's, and I love that he, like, opens it and he considers, idea. Like, you know what, he's like,
It's like,
no.
I love, there's just such comedy, though, in the way he does it, when he just throws the rest of the orange juice over the thing. Like, I just think that's brilliant, when he throws it over the mailbox. Yeah. It's just the icing on the cake. But, yeah, he's terrible.
Although it must mean that Mike came out of the sewer or whatever, came out from below the ground for a long enough to repair the mailbox, leave that message. You know, I'm not sure about that.
Is that, I never actually thought about who fixed it. I thought it was going to, I bet Mike makes sense if he came out of the ground. If he's going to be able to come out of the ground, why doesn't he just run away?
Yeah, also in broad daylight as well, well, covered in mess. Maybe that's a great point. Maybe, like, Mulder's wee was like Austin Powers. You know, when Austin Powers goes to the toilet after he's unthawed and it's like 5 hours. Maybe that was what it was. That's how Mike had time.
Or maybe it was, what's the wife, the next door, Wynn's wife? What's her name? We've said it.
Cammy.
Yeah, Cammy. Sorry. Okay. Maybe it was Cammy walking Scruffy and she fixed it. That might Could be more logical, I guess.
I like Mike the best. Yeah. That's great.
Trash Mike. He's not Big Mike anymore. He's Trash Mike now.
So yeah. The episode kind of, I would say, oscillates a bit between being lighter and being more serious. So, like, you get later when, after the basketball hoop's been cleared away, because Mulder goes out and, like, pushes the buttons with that when he's playing at 10:30 at night or whatever. But then Scully comes home. She's got the shopping bag concealing the lab report, which I think was kind of funny. Again, the surface is different to what's underneath. But that stuff in that, you know, when she's walking around the house and all that. So it's trying to be quite tense, isn't it? It's reasonably effective. It's not what I really enjoy about this episode. What I really enjoy are the lighter elements and less about the monster and more about the battle between mostly Mulder and Scully against the locals. You know, so I never feel too tense about it all.
No, it's not. If I'm honest, I think those moments my attention wavered slightly. I like you said, they're not badly done. You know, there's nothing wrong with them, but it's not like, you know, irresistible. You know, where you Scully's under threat and that guy, which is really quite tense. It's fine. It needs to be there, I suppose, to prevent it being an all out sitcom, basically. You know. But yeah, it wasn't. Although, you know, I do appreciate how bloody and nasty some of this episode is, actually. And I was really surprised. Like, my wife said, when in the scene where Mulder comes in, and actually, in retrospect, it's quite a horrific moment because he doesn't know Scully's there. He comes into the house at the end, and it's blood splattered everywhere. It's like
blood,
an
though?
Axe murderer. Well, sorry, yeah, motor oil and, you know, it's ketchup. It's splattered everywhere, like an axe murderer or some psychopath has been in there, like a horrific murder scene. And he doesn't know Scully's all right. Like, for a split second as he walks in, I'm thinking, is he thinking Scully's been like, horrifically butchered?
Yeah, I love the genuine
butchered?
Fear there. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can see it on
and
his
that
face.
That's really different to a lot of the, you know, the comedy and the lightness. So I really appreciate those aspects, definitely.
And one of my other favorite moments of this episode is, like, you know, when she gets out of the car and she's like doing, they're actually investigating a case, which you don't really get to see often. But my favorite part is when, you know, she's in the bathroom and he comes back from his jog and he throws the necklace on the, he's got it collected, the evidence, because, you know, and you obviously know, like, she told him, like, I saw the caduceus and it's there, but we have to go get it. And I couldn't get it. And so she, you know, he's like, all right, I'm going to go for a jog, pretend to go for a jog. And he got it. And so how casually he just sees, like, you know, they're actually making a really good team there and investigating. Mm. And I really like that part.
Yeah.
So apparently when Daniel Arkin had the idea, the main antagonist that they summoned was a man who was kind of the bogeyman figure. And if what I've read is accurate, it was Chris Carter who said that he should replace that with an actual monster. And that's when the idea of, like, the Tulpa myth sort of came in and all that. So what we get here is, yeah, the neighborhood is built upon landfill. So it's, and the monster is, like, literal garbage. You know, it's ketchup, brake fluid, brush bristles and all that.
Yeah.
So very plain, isn't it? You know, the idea of the perfect surface is rotten underneath.
Yeah, and I think it's a good, I think Chris Carter was probably right in here, actually, because it's a good metaphor in itself, even if it's literal, you know, making the underbelly, you know, the garbage, the rubbish, you know, the what you discard into the literal monster. But I actually like the whole Gogolak thing, as much as it's like a bit, the mechanism of it isn't really explained, and there's no real, it's just, oh, you went to Tibet and you did something and you had some sort of powers. It's like, there's no real tether there. You don't really ever understand how that's possible. You don't know anything about his past, really, except he's this businessman. Presumably he's been a businessman for years. He goes to Tibet and has learnt some of the mysticism. But I still think it's a good mechanism to sort of get into, you know, how this man essentially has created this sense of control and community under the guise of it being this perfect American life. And he's done it through creating a literal underbelly that will kill you if you don't conform and if you don't do what ultimately he wants. You know, he is those CCNRs essentially. You know, that's him. And what, and I find it interesting to think about, what does he represent? You know, what does Gogolak represent as a character? You know, because he is, you know, he's quite well played by, I think it's Peter White, the actor who plays him. You know, he's quite cold and calculating and creepy in the performance, but he's not really a massively fleshed out character. But what, like I say, what he represents is perhaps what interests me even more. So I quite like the Tulpa and all that stuff.
Yeah. No, I quite like it too. Like I said earlier, I think it lacks a bit of subtlety, but it does the job well enough, and it's kind of interesting. And I think if this had been like a monster hunt episode, you know, if this had been something like The Host, where it's all about them tracking down this monster, and it was less about the community and more about there's this neighborhood where the monster's on the loose, then the visual unsatisfyingness of the monster would be a problem.
Definitely.
And maybe the lack of plausibility or whatever would be a problem. But because it's not really about that in the same way, it doesn't concern me.
Yeah, completely. Because it's the monster is just the mechanism in many ways. And that's why it's sort of underused in a sense. In fact, you know, weirdly, it reminded me, and this isn't an it might have been an inspiration on it, but it wasn't an inspiration for Arcadia. It reminded me of a certain couple of episodes in Lost, again, a show which is, you know, owes a lot to the X-Files, in that there's a monster that attacks this, you know, in quotes, perfect community that exists on this mystical island, and it is summoned through, you know, a strange mechanism that goes back to a long time ago, and it's summoned as punishment ultimately, and it's summoned to kill people who are threatening that environment and threatening that community. So it's, and that itself has its roots in mysticism, and I think there are some really interesting ideas about that idea of summoning something, you know, to protect an idea, to protect, you know, in this case, this quote unquote perfection, hence the, you know, the Arcadia itself is a reference to, you know, an ancient sort of utopia almost, I believe. It's something along those lines. So it's, you know, it's very interesting how it's even though the ancient mysticism isn't really, or the Tibetan mysticism isn't really delved into too much, I think it kind of works. It works to sell the idea. Although, because the episode is, like you say, more about the jokey side and all the back and forth between the community, it doesn't go too heavily into that. And I think maybe that's why the ending does tail off a little bit. I think the ending is a little bit flat, to, you know.
Yeah, well, okay, so listeners, Sarah Blair's just, she stepped out a second because she's doing some childcare.
Her light's gone off outside, she's just gone to fix it. Oh, there she comes, she's back.
She's covered in blood, or is it that wrong?
Yeah.
Hey, Sarah.
Here we go. Sorry.
Did you fix the light at the lamp outside, Sarah? Is it okay now?
I did. Yeah. It's all good. Okay, good. We're safe. All right. That good. Was a close cool. one. Okay. House. Yeah. Gosh.
Tony was just saying about how the ending, like the last few minutes of the episode, maybe trails off a bit. I think that's true after. I really like Mulder's gambit of installing a reflecting pool. He's like, oh, look, there's nothing in the CCNR says I can't do this. I think that's very clever, actually. Yeah. I think it's Marlene in the comments says it's after that point where maybe it kind of wanes a bit. And I think she's got a point that it wanes and then it gets it back a bit with the final summation, the voiceover. Do we concur?
Oh, sorry.
Sarah, I've talked loads, so you go for it.
Oh, can you, sorry, my husband just texted me about breakfast. Sorry.
Just like, woman, get in here and make me a sandwich.
he's asking me, yeah, do you want some pancakes and eggs and turkey bacon? I was like, yeah, are you fixing it? Sounds good.
That is good.
Okay, sorry, Carl, I apologize. Can you say that one more time?
Does it tail off a bit towards the end, basically, Sarah?
I think the pacing goes a little fast. But it's, I think it doesn't bother me because it's exciting stuff, and so I think they build up and then the ending does go pretty quick as far as the pacing goes, but there's once you figure out the mystery and what's happening, there's not much left to it, you know what I mean? So I don't find fault with it. I think it works for what it is, and you know, it all sort of culminates in this trash mess. Trash fire mess. So, yeah.
I never felt a huge amount of mystery to the whole episode, really. I mean, I couldn't have told you the specifics first time round, but I feel like it's very evident very quickly that this community is... they've all got a secret, basically. Because they're so broad that there's not much else you can... There's not much of another way you can interpret that, I find. But again, I don't hold that against the episode.
I think you're right, but I think what obviously you don't know is how this is happening and why and how it's, you know, and I think there's no way to guess that because the answer is so
kind of arcane,
you know, specific. Yeah. There's no way to go, oh, this is probably a tulpa. There's no way to guess that. Like, you know, so you're right. The mystery of how it's happening is there, but yeah, you're right in that there's no mystery about the construction. Yeah.
I did want to mention that ending voiceover, because Mulder and Scalia, this is as Mulder and Scalia leaving, and what we discover, it's quite rare actually to have a voiceover like this at all at this point in the series, so it's kind of nice to see one of them again, or to hear
old
one
school.
Of them again.
Yeah.
The residents have come forward to blame Gogolak, but they deny the fact that they share any of the culpability. They're kind of pleading ignorant to what else went on. So that's an interesting idea, isn't it? The code of silence has survived. Gogolak becomes like the fall guy. And then the Thalls of Arcadia is still apparently one of the most popular planned communities of this type in California for, I believe it's the sixth year in succession. So that's kind of almost kind of a chilling indictment of the whole community, isn't it? It's not, they haven't learned their lesson. They just regret the fact that it kind of spilled out and it led to what it led
to. Do you think the trash monster disappeared with Gogolak? Was it his manifestation?
Yeah.
And now they feel like, well, it wasn't our fault. It was Gogolak. So now that he's gone, we can continue living this life and maybe not, you know, be so restrictive on the CCNRs and it'll be fine, you know?
Or we could, you know, we can still try and live in a very prescribed community. It's just that there isn't an actual monster policing it now.
But what's going to happen if the monster's not there to make them afraid, you know? How
I don't know.
What are the rules going to get more lax? And then
we could have seen like a sequel to this episode where like Doggett and Reyes have to return to Arcadia. Yeah. Or Miller and Einstein or somebody. You know.
That would have been good. I think it is, though, that's it, exactly it, Sarah, and that it did die with Gogolak because it was Gogolak's creation. This whole thing was Gogolak's creation. And I think that's, but their ignorance after the fact and their refusal to accept responsibility is the cowardice inherent mm-hmm. in what they bought into. You know, I mean, it said it all when, you know, Cammy's screaming when the trash monster's there. And Mulder runs out to try and help her, but Wynn doesn't. Wynn just stands there watching, you know, like he's afraid. He doesn't run to help his wife. Mm-hmm. So that tells you all you need to know about these kind of people who, in theory, represent either quote-unquote perfect couples, successful couples, you know, people who've achieved in the American way of life. But in fact, they're liars and they're cowards. And, you know, it is a sham. The whole thing's a sham. And I think that, from a cultural perspective, is really interesting, actually, especially at the end of the 1990s when America was in this point of peace and prosperity compared to where we are now, but that underbelly is there, you know, and I think it's saying a lot about the position of the sham that is this American success and this American perfection and this American achievement, really. And I hate to say that, Sarah, as somebody who's American, but you know, I don't mean that for all Americans. I mean that for, well, it's, you know, yeah. In this instance.
Like, it's,
you know,
all about appearances. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Tony, there's nothing designed to stir up an American's patriotism more than a British person critiquing American society.
Yeah, definitely. And let me just postscript this with, we are nowhere in a better position in Britain, I tell you. All right, so it could just as easily be here. This is happening in its own way, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's Western society in a way. I think that whole idea of this, you know, achievement, this perfection, I think it's sort of playing on that idea that it might not be as perfect as you think it is. You know, like you said earlier, guys, like what we think is there is always a hidden side to it, or there is always a subtext. That's my way out of what I just said, by the way.
It wouldn't be the
digging.
It wouldn't be the falls at Arcadia. It would be like the falls at Pops on Walls or something, right?
Yeah.
All your fun
names. Yeah.
Midsummer Murders would be the equivalent. Have you ever seen Midsummer Murders, Sarah?
I've got it on my list. I haven't actually watched it.
Oh, you,
I know.
You would
Everybody
love that
says
show.
That I will, so I've got it.
You would.
You know, I need to watch.
You would.
I think it would be good.
You really do. You do.
Mm-hmm.
Any final thoughts on Arcadia before we dive into our desert sienna-coloured mailbag?
Desert sage. You've got to paint it quick.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah, I'm good.
I'm fun. I'm good.
It's a fun episode. That trash monster man. Something else.
Okay. Once I've finished attaching this whirligig to the roof, I'll open the mailbag. Okay, so like I said earlier, we had a lot of stuff in this week. I've been selective. I've tried to pull out quite a few comments, though, because there was such a range of opinion. So let's go through them. From Kathy Glinsky, first of all, who said, I love the tension between Mulder and Scully in this episode. There's clearly something uncomfortable going on between them under the surface. It's not all light and fluffy. These two are still working out some issues, and the perfect community with a dark secret is a very effective metaphor for their relationship at this point.
I think they don't. This isn't there's never really been an episode of The X-Files where they've sat down and talked through everything with their relationship together, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't think there ever will be, you know, I don't think it's that kind of show, you know, I think ultimately Arcadia is a really good way of sort of playing on some of the ideas and the romantic tropes and the shipper tropes and all these kind of things that fans know about. And I think in that sense, it does that, but like I said before, it's artifice and it's satire and it knows it is. So, yeah.
So one or two other people have mentioned about where it falls in the chronology of their relationship and so on, which we'll come to shortly. But Paige Schechter says, this is one I used to like a lot more than I do now. I don't think it makes the most of either its comic moments. And she says, oh boy, let's see Dana react to a badly packaged box of China being dropped. Nor its intimate opportunities. Cue Mulder's reaction to the tired face mask cliche. This scenario was done much better in Our Town, and our leads felt closer with more at stake then. Eps like this go a long way to explaining why Season 6 is considered X-Files light. So because we haven't spoken to you, Tony, we don't really know where you stand on the whole X-Files light in total. You know, Triangle Dreamland ranking, How to Ghost Stole Christmas, all that. Are you fond of that turn that was taken?
Yeah. I mean, I'm fond of most of the episodes. You know, I think the ranking goes a little bit far, but I'm fond of them all, and I think it's nice. And I think really X-Files Light it could be taken as a criticism, but I don't necessarily think it is. I think there is place for both. I think there's place for both approaches, and I think the show has earned by this point the space to do episodes like Arcadia. But I think Paige is right about the lack of stakes and the lack of tension. We're at that point now where, you know, we know that they're going to be okay. You know, it's not like where Scully's got her head in a chopping block, you know, in Our Town or anything like that. And we knew she was going to be okay then because she's the lead of a show in a network age of television. You know, it's not like Ned Stark in Game of Thrones. Oh, spoiler, sorry. But, like, you know, sorry about that.
I think if anybody doesn't know that by now, then
well, I'd hope they do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I get what Paige's point is, you know, that there aren't that many stakes. And I think that is part of the X-Files-like thing and why it doesn't appeal to some people, because it isn't in that space where they're particularly under threat or they're in danger. But I think there's some fantastic comedy and character work in there, and this is a great example of it. So yeah, I can see both sides of it.
What Cortland Waters-Bartley says is, this is one I always want to enjoy a lot more than I actually do as I rewatch. I think it misses some opportunities for deeper character moments between Mulder and Scully. That said, I enjoy the dark underbelly theme and seeing them undercover, an FBI role we don't get to see much of in the X-Files department. What do you think, Sarah? Misses some opportunities? Could there have been this episode where it is a bit deeper between the two of them?
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen a conversation on the rock style. Not necessarily like that, you know, personal, but I feel like that scene, you know, I think there could have been more insight into their characters and places. When they had the chance to discuss their relationship. And I mean, y'all know in my head canon about Redux, my Redux theory. So, yeah. You know, in my head canon, there's a lot going on here that they've already been together romantically and they've had this big fight and now they're...
Have you written this? Have you essayed this yet? Have you put this into an essay?
Have you not read it?
I mean, I fanficked it.
I remember you fanficked it.
Yeah.
I mean, like an actual critical essay where you break down why.
I guess I could.
You should do that.
Yeah.
You should do that. Yeah.
We'll see. Maybe one day.
Let me run through a few mixed responses. So, Dina Ferrari says, it has its fun moments and I enjoy it once in a while, but season 6 has a way of joking about Mulder and Scully's relationship that I dislike. Instead of sweet little glimpses and hints of how much they love and care for one another, we're being hit over the head with comedy about them being attracted to each other, but not acknowledging it, which is really not funny. But on the other hand, I think it's kind of clever, because the hypothetical happy ending, in addition to hand touching and kissing of foreheads, also includes a lot of being annoyed at the person you love for how they squeeze a tube of toothpaste. Caradwen Foley says, in all honesty, I can't stand this episode. To me, it's like bad fanfic come to life. I find the whole undercover married trope so cringy. Michelle Milbauer says, as a shipper, this is an episode that I'm supposed to like, but I really don't. It feels so forced and awkward that I feel uncomfortable watching it. And then Jessica Miskelly says, I'm somewhere between Dina and Caradwen. It is certainly more camp than the X-Files I fell in love with. And while I appreciate the humorous episodes immensely, this sort of humor is mostly too blatant for my taste. It's also jarring character-wise for Mulder. Only 2 episodes ago, we had one son. Does he think he can go from that scene at the Lone Gunman's to being all jokey again? Scully's reactions are much more on point. Yes, I know the X-Files is only partly an encompassing story arc, but this is one of those standalone episodes where the disconnect is off-putting. On the whole, too cutesy with insufficient depth. So I wonder if that disconnect she's talking about, I wonder if that would have been more obvious if this had aired directly after One Son, or would it not really have mattered for most viewers?
It's funny, I was talking about this in relation to Paperclip and DPO in a different way recently, about how, you know, it's so... And I think it was a conversation, actually, around Aguamala as well, in that Aguamala is such a shift from One Son, and it doesn't feel like there's much of a landing strip, you know, even though... And I feel like that's part of this, in that the X-Files doesn't do... You know, it's still rooted in that... It doesn't have the serialization to sort of carry these things through in the same way. You know, you have your mythology, where all the personal stuff happens, and then snap, you're in the middle of... you know, a completely standalone kind of thing where you have the characters and their archetypes, and you might get hints and nods towards certain things, but you don't get any explanation. Television isn't written like that anymore. You know, it's very seldom written like that. Nor nowadays, you will have an ongoing story arc or an ongoing character arc, and you will have references in all of those episodes that sort of flow into each other. Sometimes that works for the better, sometimes it doesn't. You know, there's room for both approaches. But I can see what she means, in that you do suddenly, with the X-Files, snap from one state to another, and especially when you have huge episodes of massive import, and then you go to something really knockabout, it can really throw you off. Yeah.
Well, to add to that a little bit, you guys know I've been rewatching Castle. But one of the, and I know you guys haven't seen this, so spoiler alert, but one of the things that I feel...
Does Ned Stark get his head chopped off?
I'm not going to say. I'm not going to let you know.
That happens in every show. Yeah.
So, but one of the things that I think Castle took from the X-Files and made it work for that show is the idea that these two people could be attracted to each other and meet and work together on a constant basis. And they acknowledge the fact that they're both really good looking people and they're both into each other. But, you know, she holds off and is like, yeah, this is not going to happen. But they acknowledge it from the very beginning that, you know, they're attracted to each other. And that's one of the things that I feel like, you know, the X-Files, they didn't know what they had. To be fair, at the beginning, they didn't know that these two actors were going to develop such chemistry with each other. They didn't know that the X-Files was going to turn into what it was. And so by the time you get to season six, where we're at now, it's clear the fans recognize it. And, you know, you've got Chris Carter over here being like, platonic, platonic, platonic. And so there's like this push and pull. Yeah, it's push and pull between that. And
the fans are thirsty. The fans are thirsty by this point, aren't they?
But, you know. Yeah.
Is it all the fans, though?
Not all the fans, to be fair. Quite a few of the fans.
Yeah. So yeah. I think by this point, it's like we want them to acknowledge that they're attracted to each other. But at the same time, you know, they're still holding back on that. And it creates like this weird kind of frustration and dynamic. Whereas I think if they would have just maybe acknowledged it right out at some point, or just, you know, I don't know, it's just, it's different. But I think that that's one of the reasons why Castle works so well, is because they're like, all right, we've got two hot people, they've got chemistry, we're gonna make this a thing and go from there. And it's great. They do an amazing job at it. Whereas, you know,
just a few more, because we had lots of really good stuff in. Chandru, I'll just abridge his comment, but what I liked from him was, he said, the big question is, would Skinner really have assigned them as an undercover married couple? Throughout the episode, Mulder seems determined to blow their cover by going over the top, and I'm left wondering why Skinner thought this was a good idea. Maybe this was actually Krychek blackmailing Skinner with the nanomachines from SR-819. Maybe deep down beneath his rat boy exterior, Krychek is just a shipper at heart. It's kind of like that. I like that idea. Kurt North said, I love this episode. Yeah, very good. Kurt North says, I love this episode. Mulder's playfulness really shines through. He's enjoying it so much, from the like the dish to woman, get back here and make me a sandwich, which I've quoted several times. And I can hear Kurt
saying that. How did that turn out for you?
How did it go down? The monster is a bit lame, but I like that. It's good to see the actor Abraham Ben Ruby, who I believe is Big Mike. I was a fan of ER at the time, so I got a thrill from it. The suburban locale, gated community with a secret, plays out in a totally different way to the way Millennium was doing it at the time. Yeah, because it was enjoyable, wasn't it? it wasn't unremittingly grim, I think.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Time is now, listeners. Just kidding. The questioning from both Mulder and Scully is a thrill. Jumping out of character, poking the bear. A great ep. Cheers, Kurt. Just finally, Marlene left a very nice comment. I've always enjoyed Arcadia. It's a fun farce, a sort of play on Home in the teaser. And Mulder's idea to install a reflecting pool in the front yard is a hilariously creative improvisation in investigative strategy. That said, I think the underlying mood of season six isn't lightheartedness, but rather unease. And Arcadia fits perfectly with that. The comical surface of Mulder and Scully in an outlandish undercover assignment with a campy disappearance plot and villain and cardboard cultish neighbours. But an underbelly, as Mulder says, of hidden things buried underground. I think the story and the entertainment loses steam toward the end after Mulder and Scully find the whirly gig. but Scully's end monologue repeating Mulder's claim that the entire community was complicit is effective, and ending with the Falls again being ranked one of the top planned communities of California is funny and chilling. And she says, as an aside, her mother always mentioned this episode as the most realistic X-File because of the compulsive behaviour of the Neighbourhood Rules Committee, those CCNRs.
Can I just go back to Chandru's comment? Because I think this is an indication that Chandru has watched the Davy Train. Because if you remember in the Davy Train, there was that episode where Dave Krawczyk and Steve Skinner both went undercover into the halls in Arcadia. It's called the Halls in Arcadia, if you remember.
Student halls, was it?
Yeah, but it was a really progressive episode because they were pretending to be a gay couple, you know, and they were pretending to be like a gay couple at uni, at university, you know, at college, in order to smoke out, you know, another trash monster. It was a great episode, and it very much a sequel. You know, Gene Gogolak comes back, but he's also a teenager. It's weird. I don't quite know how they did that. But
it was a great episode of the Davy Train, but there was the explainy train coverage of it I found quite unsatisfying. I don't know about you.
Well, it's Matt Lavin for you, you know. It's Yeah, don't bother with that. Just watch the episode.
If only they'd learned to put down the toilet seat. That's just...
Oh, yeah. I know. That was terrible.
That was unfortunate, to be fair.
Yeah.
Anything else, guys, before we wrap up? I think we've fully raked over this one, everyone.
I think that there's one final thing that I'm... that very Columbo. One final thing. going to Columbo you all. Did I dream this, or does Mulder put a pink flamingo in the garden?
Mm. Yeah.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Because I kept... Suddenly, I had a moment in my head earlier where I went, pink flamingo. That's another
Bring
thing he
on.
Puts in the garden.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just,
and it disappears
just thought
pretty
it would
quick,
be worth
right?
mentioning it. And it disappears yeah. quickly. So somebody's got a pink flamingo in their garage, you know, and it's going to come out one day.
All right, guys. So just before we go... Sarah, where are you online these days and what you're up to?
I am on Twitter at Sarah L. Blair, and I'm on Instagram at author.sarah.blair.
Very good.
I'm on Instagram at Sarah. No, I can't get it right. Forget it. Just, nope. Just find
you're
me on Twitter.
On Instagram.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I'm on Instagram.
You're on it.
Find me.
And Tony, how about you?
On Twitter, AJ Black Writer, my website, culturalconversation.co.uk. And I mean, generally on various different things, but you'll find me through there. Also, as if you're a patron of the XCast, you'll hear me on things like the commentary track for Monday, which came out recently, which is a lot of fun, and various other things that are going to be coming up. I think we've talked, I think, backstage about doing another drinking commentary with fire and space, and I think I'm going to be involved in that one next
nice.
Time as well, so that's gonna be fun, I think. We need to bring that one together soon as well.
Yeah, I'd like to do that, because that last one was probably my social highlight of the last year.
yeah I'll want so, in on the next one.
I'm on Twitter at CKJ Sweeney. I'm also pretty active in the X-Files Basement, which is our X-Cast fan group on Facebook. That's all for this episode, listeners. We'll be back soon with the next episode, but until then, always remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. The time is now. A Millennium Podcast.
I hate Hollywood. I hate the way these stories are told. It's everything, they hit the same beats, they hit the same rhythms. It's kind of like, it, you know, reminds me of like a blues thing, you know, where it's like, well, a lot of people love the blues, but you know, it just, I realize that it's everything has the same underlying structure, you know, everything is like 12 bar, 1-4-5, pentatonic, you know, everything is following the same core elements, and it just gets exhausting after a while.
It does. I remember going to see Gary Moore. And, you know, as much as I enjoy music, I enjoy going to see bands and things. And after about, I'd say, 30 minutes, I was like, I need to check out.
We buy records. How much would you sell this record for on Discogs? Now, the record in question is Microsoft DOS on a vinyl album, which you can actually boot a PC with.
You've got to be kidding.
I'm not kidding. Does this sound bringing back any memories? From what I can gather, it looks like they've done it as a hobby project. But if it was commercially available...
All it needs is an incredibly vaporwave sleeve. And I guarantee that hipsters would pay a fortune for that.
We are Starfleet.
So this was kind of a nice callback to the elements that were used on TOS. And it really stuck out to me. And it just, as I keep saying every week, you know, there's always a little give and take, right? Where the writers bring in this element from TOS or TNG or from Voyager, and it fits into the Discovery realm.
Yeah, and I'm glad that they didn't draw out Giorgio seeking medical attention for her issue. Is a little worried.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.